Raw Spice Bar is the best way to get freshly ground spices from around the world delivered right to your door. They have a subscription membership service offering freshly ground, small batch, recipe-ready spices and spice blends. They have several spice plans available to suit everyone's needs, ranging from $10 a month to $100 a month. Raw Spice Bar also has individual spices and spice blends to purchase on their own. My favorites are the Greek blend. I love garlic, so the Grateful Garlic blend. The Sweet Carolina Dry Rub is excellent. I tried one of their newest blends, the Chili Starter blend. I'm on their email subscription list, and they sent a recipe for chili cheese fries using the Chili Starter blend, and they were so good. Raw Spice Bar even has gift cards. Gift cards come in increments of $30, $60, $90, and $120. And you can customize your gift with a personal message. Start cooking new dishes with Raw Spice Bar. Link is in the description. Hello, and welcome to another episode. I've been following this case from the very beginning, even before the murder. This case involves partying, drugs, and a brutal murder. Andre, who went by Angel, was born on May the 1st, 1971, in the country of Colombia. His family moved to New York City in the United States when he was 8 years old. I couldn't find too much information, but I know that he had an older brother named Johnny. When Andre was in his teen years, he knew he was gay and struggled with it because he came from a very religious upbringing. In the late 1980s, early 90s, Andre became a part of the nightclub scene in New York City. And as most of us do in our 20s, he was finding himself and finding who he was through nightclubs. And he was introduced to members of the Club Kids. The Club Kids were a group of young nightclub personalities in New York City in the late 80s and throughout the 90s. The club was known for its members' flamboyant behavior and outrageous homemade costumes, wigs, dramatic makeup, and of course the high platform shoes. The group is still recognized as an artistic and fashion conscious youth culture. Several club kids have made long-lasting contributions to mainstream art and fashion. During this time, the club kids were on all of the daytime talk shows, and that's how I got to know who the club kids were. Some costumes were outrageous, and some were beautiful. To me, it seemed like a fun lifestyle. You get to dress up in this costume and go dancing. In the early years of the Club Kids, they would have random parties in random locations. This was before the internet. So the club promoter, Michael, would tell some regulars, hey, let's meet at the subway station at this time. And, you know, invite as many people as you want. So 100 people would show up in elaborate costumes at this location. Music would be playing, people would be dancing. They would usually stay at that location until the police came, and then they would go to a club. Anyone could be a club kid, but to be a part of the inner circle was extremely exclusive. And you needed to be approved by Michael, the club promoter. and Michael only wanted fabulous people in the inner circle. Although Andre knew many in the inner circle, Michael didn't think Andre was fabulous. Andre worked on creating his club kid persona and became Angel. His trademark costume was a set of feathered wings, and sometimes they were huge. I think I heard they would span like 6 feet wide. He would have his feathered wings, leather pants, combat boots with chains, and he would wear a mohawk. Former club kids said that the first time they saw Angel, it literally took their breath away. He looked so cool. Early in his nightclub days, Andre became a drug dealer. He didn't use the drugs, but he would sell drugs at the clubs. When Michael saw Andre's new persona, Angel, he allowed Angel into the inner circle. Angel looked cool and he could supply drugs in the club. Michael often put drug dealers on the payroll at the clubs. He would say their title was promotions or something legit, and then that would allow them to be on the club's payroll. Michael was born on April 29, 1966, in South Bend, Indiana. His parents were John and Elke. Elke was from Germany and came to the United States when she married John. They were divorced when Michael was 4 years old. Michael had an older brother. Michael was a straight-A student, but during his teenage years, he was often bullied because he was gay. After graduating high school in 1984, he attended Fordham University in New York City. He studied architecture before transferring to the Fashion Institute of Technology. There, he met someone who introduced him to the New York City nightlife. Michael dropped out of school and began working as a busboy at one of the clubs. He studied the nightclub business and soon became a party promoter. His ability to stage memorable parties helped him rise in the New York party scene. Michael and other regular club goers began creating flamboyant personas that became known as club kids. At first, Michael didn't partake in drugs, and he was really against using them. But he knew that it drew people into the clubs. He would tell a regular, you know, come to the club and I'll give you some ecstasy, or I'll give you a gram of coke. You know, if you bring people with you, I'll give you more drugs. So Michael knew drugs would bring money into the club. At first, the drug ecstasy was the favorite in the clubs. Ecstasy reduces high levels of serotonin, which regulates mood, energy level, and appetite. Basically, it makes you happy and you feel good. And apparently, you feel great. Everything you touch feels great. At some point, Michael started doing drugs. The story I heard was that Michael had a boyfriend who was a drug user, and instead of coming out to the clubs with Michael, the boyfriend would stay at home doing drugs. So frustrated one day, when the boyfriend was out, Michael decided to snort all of his cocaine. And apparently he really liked that feeling, and soon he became an addict. The club kids scene started with a happy drug like ecstasy, but went to cocaine, heroin, and ketamine, known as Special K, which is an animal tranquilizer. It went from happy club goers dancing all night to zombie strung out people passed out at the club. Around this time, another drug dealer, Freeze, was added to the payroll, and he brought many of the hard drugs. Freeze did not like Angel, and he thought Angel didn't belong in their inner circle, and he was very vocal about it. Freeze would also point out that Angel didn't do the drugs. So how would he know if they were any good if he wasn't doing them? And so a lot of people stopped buying through Angel. Angel saw what was happening to the group, and he didn't mind dealing the drugs when it was happy people dancing and having fun. But when it came to like the passed out zombie strung out drug users, he just didn't want to be a part of that lifestyle. He was preparing to make changes in his life and maybe even move to California. Angel was going to people who owed him money, including Michael. Michael owed Angel thousands of dollars. Sometime in March 1996, Angel just disappeared. Club kids weren't seeing him in or outside of the club, and his family hadn't heard from him. Some knew Angel wanted to get away from that scene and thought maybe he did move to California. In the weeks following Angel's disappearance, Michael allegedly told anyone who would listen that he and Freeze had killed Angel. Most people didn't believe Michael and thought he was high on drugs and that his confession was a way to get attention. Even during an interview, like a televised interview, before the interview started, they wanted Michael to check his microphone and said, you know, say some words. And Michael said, "I killed Angel. We hacked him up in pieces and threw him into the river." No one reported anything. They just thought he was making it up for attention. Michael had this power, or like manipulation, over a lot of the club kids. They would really do anything he said. I heard in an interview, this is kind of gross, but I heard that Michael would say to someone, you know, "Pee your pants right now." And the person would like pee their pants right there. Another time he would tell, you know, "You pee into a cup and then you over here, you drink that pee." And then they would do it, like these crazy things. And he would just be like, "Do this, do that." And his followers would do it. So it's really no surprise that no one reported his confessions. Angel's brother was going to various clubs, and he even went to Michael's apartment to find information on where Angel might be, and no one would talk. Angel's brother was baffled by what he regarded as callous indifference by the police and by the club kids Angel considered his friends. Angel is missing and Michael is confessing, but nothing is being done. So a reporter for the Village Voice wrote an article on April 26, 1996, covering Angel's disappearance and reported rumors of Michael's involvement in Angel's death. Although no names were used, reports included the details of the murder. It also reported that Michael was recently fired from a club he was working at, supposedly over drug use and coming to work under the influence. The following day, the New York Post's page 6 column ran a lead item on Angel's disappearance. Over the coming weeks, the Village Voice continued to report and make accusations about Angel's murder. Through September 1996, the police still had not questioned Michael about the murder. Several months had passed, and many people believed Michael would get away with murdering Angel. In November 1996, children were playing in the water at Oakwood Beach, Staten Island. They saw a box on the bank of the river and thought it might be treasure. But the box contained a legless torso. The coroner reported the body and it was identified as Angel. New York has what they call boroughs, kind of like different counties. And each county has its own jurisdiction. So I believe in an interview it said that, you know, the legs were found in this borough, and then the torso was found in this borough. And they didn't really communicate, and maybe had they communicated with each other, Angel's case could have been solved easier. When police went to arrest Michael, they found that he had left New York, but he was located in New Jersey in a motel room rented by his drug dealer boyfriend. On December 5th, 1996, Michael and Freeze were arrested. Shortly after his arrest, Freeze confessed to police, and then Michael confessed once he was told. It was like the police told Freeze, well, Michael already confessed, so you might as well tell us what happened. And then they told Michael, Freeze already confessed, so then that kind of scenario happened. So this is what allegedly happened. On Sunday, March 17th, 1996, Angel went to Michael's apartment to collect money owed to him. Michael had been making excuses for a few weeks, so Angel was getting angry and confrontational when Michael made excuses that night of why he couldn't give the money to Angel. An argument started, and then the confrontation became violent. Angel and Michael started physically fighting. Michael called out to Freeze, who was living at the apartment. Freeze then hit Angel on the head with a hammer 3 times. And then Michael smothered Angel with either a pillow or a sweatshirt. That always kind of changed throughout interviews, whether it was a pillow or a sweatshirt. They thought that Angel had passed out, so they did some drugs and passed out. And then when they woke up, they realized that Angel was dead. Apparently, they did some more drugs and then decided to pour a cleaner like a Pine Sol or a Drano into Angel's mouth. And then they wrapped duct tape over the mouth. They took off his clothes and placed Angel's body in the bathtub, where it stayed for 5 to 7 days. They would repeatedly pour cleaner over his body to prevent the body from smelling. They had guests over all the time. This was like a drug apartment, so. But Michael and Freeze would explain the smell away by saying the shower was backed up or that it was broken. Excuses like that. So this part can be a little bit graphic if you want to fast forward a little. In 3, 2, 1, Freeze purchased 2 chef's knives and a cleaver, and Michael dismembered Angel's legs. They wrapped them separately in garbage bags and then into individual duffel bags, and dumped them in the Hudson River. The following day, they wrapped the upper body in a sheet and a plastic garbage bag, placed it in a cardboard box, and then took the box down the elevator through the main lobby and then placed it in the trunk of a taxi, and then took the taxi to a bridge where they threw the box into the river. Again, apparently a lot of people were around in the lobby, and yeah, like nothing was reported. It's just kind of baffling. Michael and Freeze were offered a plea deal, 10 to 20 years if they accepted the lesser charge of manslaughter. So what I believe I heard is the police were trying to get the club owner. I'm not sure if it was like that he knew drug use was happening in his clubs, or if it was like a bookkeeping type of thing. But they thought if Michael and Freeze testified against the club owner at a trial, then they would be able to charge the club owner. But that didn't happen. I guess the owner was extradited into Canada, and then nothing, as far as I know, came of that. So that's how they got that manslaughter deal. On October 1st, both pled guilty and were sentenced. Michael would do several interviews during this time and throughout his time in prison. The story of Angel's death would change from he was too high to know what he was doing to Michael being remorseful. And then he would say in one interview that Angel really wasn't a club kid, that Michael was just using him for free drugs. And then another time he would say him and Angel were friends, but that he thought Angel was taking advantage of him. So you never really knew what the real story was with Michael. Freeze did not do any interviews, and he was released on parole in 2010 after serving 12 years and 5 months. In June 2012, an article was published saying Freeze is a research associate with a program offering college coursework and degrees to prisoners in 5 New York prisons. Freeze was accepted to the PhD program in sociology at NYU with a 5-year fellowship. Michael came up for parole many times, but it was denied. The first time was in 2006, and he was denied. He came up for parole again in 2008, but that was denied because he failed several drug tests. In March 2009, Michael said that he finally decided to stop using drugs and that he had been sober. He was released on May 5th, 2014. The conditions of his parole stated Michael had to live in New York City. He was required to abide by an 8 p.m. curfew. He had to do random drug tests and attend drug and anger management counseling and job readiness training. He could not be in nightclubs past a certain time, which was usually his curfew time, and he could not contact Angel's family. In the months following his release, Michael did numerous interviews regarding the case. And he also expressed wanting to star in his own reality show and have an exhibition of his artwork. When he was in prison, he started doing art, so he wanted to have an exhibition. Michael had numerous club kids and mentors helping him get established in modern life. The world had really changed from 1997 to 2014, so that definitely would take some adjusting. In May 2014, reports say that Michael was attempting to sell his memoirs and was pursuing a career as a magazine writer. Starting in September 7th, 2014, Michael co-hosted a YouTube comedy show titled The PU on June 25th, 2015. He had his first and only art show held in three separate art galleries in New York City. Apparently, it was a really big deal that he had three separate art galleries showing his art. Once his probation was over, Michael became involved in Monday night party events at a nightclub called Outrage. He continued to promote and host parties and nightclubs. On February 2nd, 2017, he was arrested for trespassing and smoking crystal meth in a park around 1:30 in the morning. He pleaded guilty to trespassing for a conditional discharge. On December 24th, 2020, shortly before midnight, Michael was found unconscious by his ex-boyfriend at their Manhattan home. He was using heroin earlier that day and mentioned he felt ill, and later he was pronounced dead at the scene. He was 54. The following day, Michael's mother confirmed his cause of death was an accidental heroin overdose. In May 2021, the chief medical examiner verified that Michael died from acute intoxication from the drugs fentanyl, heroin, and methamphetamine. As I mentioned earlier, I followed this story from the very beginning, and this is probably the most unpopular thing to say, but a small part of me wanted Michael to succeed and to do something great. Like, I don't condone what he did to Angel at all, but I wanted, I don't know, to see like a murderer be remorseful and do something great with their life after they did this horrible thing. Like, I'm going to show I'm not that person. You know, I'm going to show that, I don't know. And you know, especially that he served such a light sentence. He might have been on the right track while he was on parole, but as soon as he didn't have to do drug tests and have a curfew, he went back to his own ways. He had a darkness and an addiction that he just could not get past. While in prison, Michael saw a psychologist who diagnosed him with histrionic personality disorder. That's a disorder with a pattern of exaggerated emotionality and high levels of attention-seeking behavior. The doctor said Michael was the most extreme case he had ever seen. With Michael, everything had to be completely over the top and exaggerated. There are many, many documentaries and books about this case. There was a memoir called Disco Bloodbath, A Fabulous But True Tale of Murder in Clubland, and that was written by a club kid, released in 1999. There was Party Monster, the Shockumentary, in 1998. That was a documentary. Party Monster, a 2003 movie starring Macaulay Culkin as Michael, as well as a documentary called Glory Days. That was streaming on Netflix in 2018. I'm not sure. It's not streaming in Canada, so I don't know if it still is in other countries. American Justice had an episode in 2000 called Dancing, Drugs, and Murder. In 2013, Deadly Devotion had an episode called Becoming Angel on Investigation Discovery Channel. And in 2018, a series called The 90s, The Deadliest Decade. Season 1, Episode 3 was Death of an Angel. Angel was loved by many, and they know that he can't, but they would love to see him walk into the room with his big, amazing wings. Thank you for listening.